It's kind of like the word pick six. I don't, that just like happened a few years ago and now everybody says it. Watch, now they like ESPN is like pick six, pick six.
And when it doesn't happen, they're like, we could really use a pick six right now.
Yeah, totally, totally. I'm like, cool. Like, just no one said that 10 years ago, you know?
Welcome to season six, episode four of Acquired, the podcast. Of
Ben, hey, I think you're on autopilot.
Yeah, sorry, muscle memory. All right, listeners, we are coming to you in a time of enormous change and upheaval. The coronavirus has spread around the world, challenging global health systems, bringing economies to their knees, and changing daily life for everyone, seemingly overnight. Given this, it just seems irresponsible to stay business as usual over here and put on our normal Acquired episodes for you all.
So we're changing Acquired. For the first time ever, we're taking a pause from normal episodes. The world doesn't need Acquired right now. People normally tune in to hear us talk about the stories behind great technology companies and what goes into building them, but these aren't normal times. What the world does need right now is stories of great leaders and how they and their organizations are responding to what might be the biggest moment of change we've ever seen. So we're going to take everything that we've put into Acquired over the years, our format, our infrastructure, and the way we can reach all of you, and we're going to put our full weight behind this. So starting today, we're pausing Acquired and we are launching Adapting. Adapting is a series all about doing just that, showing leadership and changing to fit what the world needs right now, not what it needed last week. So with Adapting, we're going to take a shallow dive, a more shallow dive at the beginning of each episode into the history of an organization. But our focus is really going to be on the present and on the future, not the past. We also won't be grading. Adapting requires taking risks and putting yourself out there. And anyone who's doing that right now is forever an A+ in our book.
Yep. Yeah, David, I think we were just talking about this, but I'm excited about this. It just feels right in this moment to do this.
Totally.
Listeners, we are making some important changes to the Acquired community. If you haven't joined our Slack, you can sign up on the Acquired website and find all the announcements there. And we're doing some sort of new and pretty cool things in there. If you're not yet a limited partner, now is the time to join. In addition to LP episodes, we are adding a community component to the LP program. So last week we had our first group Zoom call with everyone who's shut in at home, and it was really fun and therapeutic to get to talk with everyone. So we've decided to make it a regular monthly thing as part of the limited partner program. So we'll be announcing more details on that in the LP show. And in the meantime, you can sign up at glow.fm/acquired by clicking the link in the show notes below. And lastly, David and I feel very strongly that money should never be a reason that a single person can't become an Acquired LP. So we were talking about this beforehand, especially when introducing this new sort of community hangout component. If you can't afford a subscription, especially as we all respond to this pandemic together, even if you already are an LP, just shoot us an email, introduce yourself, and we'll take care of you.
Yeah, we felt super strongly about this. We want everyone who wants to be part of this community to be able to. So shoot us a note.
Yep. All right. Well, David, this is the perfect time to talk about one of our favorite companies, StatSig.
Yes. When we had Vijay on ACQ2 earlier this year, they were already a pretty impressive kind of Series B stage startup with a killer team and early product market fit. But what's happened since and the scale that they're operating at now is pretty wild.
This is where we get lucky in being very choosy with our sponsors. Sometimes these things happen to them while we're mid-flight.
Yes. So I asked them for some fun stats. In the past month, StatSig shipped actual live product experiments to over 1.2 billion end users. Now, that stat is not deduplicated across apps, so there's some overlap. But I mean, even if you cut that in half to approximate actual flesh and blood human people out there, that's almost 10% of the world's population.
Crazy.
Okay, so that's one. Two, StatSig now processes about 130 billion events per day. So the infrastructure that StatSig now has to support these data volumes is pretty wild. And it's not like they just execute these events. They then take all the data from them, run huge statistical jobs across the whole corpus to compute the experiment results that their customers are running. It is just wild.
It's funny, I hadn't thought to make this comparison until right now. So you said 1.7 million events a second. If you look at the Visa numbers, I just pulled up my Visa notes. Visa does 8,600 transactions per second. So that's what, 200 times as much throughput at StatSig than at Visa?
On the customer side, StatSig added arguably almost all of the most important AI companies in the world this year, including Microsoft, Atlassian, Anthropic, along, of course, with regular old companies like Notion and UiPath and Lattice and Brex and friends of the show Rec Room. The team also kept shipping super fast. At the start of the year, they had just one core product. Today, they're a full-fledged product understanding platform. They have dedicated feature flagging, warehouse native experimentation, and product analytics.
Yep. So if your team wants the best platform in the world for making data-driven product decisions, you should reach out statsig.com/acquired. And as always, there is special white glove onboarding for all acquired listeners. Our huge thanks to StatSig. Now, what is today's episode actually about? Well, we are doing an episode on a topic that we never thought we would do on this show, a local restaurant. But it is so much more than that.
Indeed.
And we think our guests' words are very inspiring and super important today. So without further ado, please enjoy our conversation with Mark Canlis of Seattle's Canlis Restaurant. All right, listeners, most of you are aware that restaurants are among those hit the hardest from our current health crisis. Canlis is leading the way in adapting to provide a product in need, delivery food, saving jobs, and ensuring the continuation of the business through trying times. Many are asking, as a city, country, and a global community, can we do this? And as Mark said in the Seattle Times earlier this week, hell yes, we can do this, and we're going to do it with burgers and bagels. So to introduce Mark, I'm going to borrow a line or a little bit of Mark's bio from the Canlis website, because I find the prose just poetic. Mark Canlis is the second of three sons. He grew up in a restaurant family. He joined Canlis in 2003 after graduating from Cornell University and serving as a captain in Air Force Special Operations. He met his wife, Anne Marie, while opening famed restaurateur Danny Meyer's fifth restaurant, Blue Smoke, in Manhattan. Returning to Seattle, Mark spearheaded the generational transfer and brand modernization that has garnered the family business national acclaim as one of the finest restaurants in America. He now owns and operates Canlis with his brother, Brian. He and Anne Marie reside on Queen Anne with their three children. And as for Canlis, Food and Wine magazine has called it one of the 40 most important restaurants in the last 40 years. They have received 22 consecutive Wine Spectator Grand Awards and been nominated for 15 James Beard Awards and won three of them. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you. It's good to be here. I also have the luxury of when you write your own bio, you can kind of make yourself sound good. I hope I haven't inflated that in any way, but thank you.
I was going to say the most important thing for Ben and for me is I know both of us have had many special memories at Canlis. So thank you guys.
No, I'm honored to be on the show.
All right, David, take us in. History and facts.
Yeah, well, so for anybody of our listeners who are in the Seattle area, and probably many who aren't, you already know a lot about Canlis. But Mark, can you give us a little bit of the history? I mean, it's a very, very special place. This isn't just another restaurant. Maybe can you go back and talk about your grandfather's story and Hawaii and Pearl Harbor?
Sure. You know, if we're going to go all the way back, I run this restaurant with my brother, Brian, and we very much feel like this is the tale of a couple different grandfathers. It's the amalgamation of four generations of Canlis's doing restaurants. Our great grandfather cooked for Teddy Roosevelt after his presidency on an African safari. I was picked up at a hotel in Egypt and invited to come along and be a steward on that whole thing for a year and a half. So really, it starts there. He and my great-grandmother would come to the United States somewhere around 1909, 1910. They started a restaurant in Stockton, California at that time and had a bunch of kids. One of them, Peter Canlis, started this restaurant, Canlis, in 1950. So That was my grandfather. He would pass away in the 70s, and my mom and dad ran this for 30 years. Brian and I have now been doing it since 2003, and in so many ways, we feel like we're just getting the hang of it. So, slow learners, but, you know, it's more or less 100 years of trying to cook for people.
There's a pretty cool military history with the restaurant and starting with Peter, too, right?
Yeah, so then on the other side of the family are a whole bunch of folks who have served in the armed forces, and that is just continues to be something that we're really proud of in this family, and something that we've many of us have chosen to do and represent, I think, some of the sweetest years, at least for my own life, and I would say that the same is true for my dad and my grandfather and my brother. So I was in the Air Force, so with Brian. Dad was in the Navy. My grandfather was a Marine for 43 years. I don't even think you can do that anymore, but back then you could. And so we have, yeah, that's just been a part of our family story. And to be completely honest, a very large influence on the way that we lead. Yesterday, we're running this crazy drive-through. We've got cars everywhere, shut down traffic, and I get a phone call, and I have hearing aids, so the thing just comes like straight into my head. It's as if like the phone is ringing in your brain. So I just answered it because I thought it was our road team. And it was the colonel that I worked for, you know, 25 years ago, Colonel Mueller, and a man that just had such a remarkable influence on the way that I lead. And it was random. I haven't talked to him in years. And I was like, Colonel Mueller, no way. I've been talking about you to everyone because in so many ways, I feel like you prepared me for this. And not just it's not about adapting your company, but the leadership, I think, the way the military teaches you to prize your people is just, you know, I just learned so much in my time in the service. So that's just been a gift to us.
That's great.
So the first iteration of Canlis, the restaurant, was on Honolulu, grew out of the USO after Pearl Harbor, right?
You know, he left the place in Stockton. He'd grown up there and he wanted nothing to do with restaurants, what his parents were doing. And he ends up in Hawaii. He's selling dry goods when Pearl Harbor happens. He remembers Zeros flying over. He was playing tennis in the morning. And like everybody, like so many people in Honolulu at the time, they kind of all headed to the base and tried to do what they could. My grandfather had quite a healthy self-esteem. Just code for, you know,
he sounds like an entrepreneur.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you. Yeah, that's a nice euphemism for, had a large ego. And at some point he finds himself talking a lot of smack inside the USO about the quality of the food. And the chef gets so upset that he kind of throws a towel at him and says, you think you do a better job? You know, you try it, which of course he does. And by the end of the war, he's running all of the food on base, for the USO. It's about kind of between 3,000 and 5,000 meals. So maybe in some way, this drive-through is us getting back to our sort of, I don't know, high volume roots, if you will, but that's what happened. And then right after the war, opened a restaurant on a beach that was a little less known before the war and certainly then before now, called Waikiki. So he had that restaurant in 1947, it was called The Broiler. And then he came to Seattle in 1950.
And Mark, just to context that for our listeners a little bit, when you say getting back to our high volume roots, for folks not from Seattle, Canlis is fine, fine dining. What does normal volume look like? What does the adapted volume look like?
I don't know. I feel like I live in a bubble and I don't really understand the real restaurant business. But in the world of, okay, so let's just try to understand fine dining for a second, because I think it's a funny term. We consider fine dining just to be the most considered form of caring for somebody with food and hospitality. It's like, so for us, we're considered to be a massive fine dining restaurant. In the world of fine dining, you know, 12 to 15 tables is pretty standard. We have 33. But on a busy night, the most guests we can serve is somewhere around 150 to 200. I have 115 employees to make that happen. So we are a model of inefficiency, and that's just six dinners a week. That's all we're doing. So wow. I say that like because I just want people to know just exactly like.
And not open for breakfast, not open for lunch.
No. Yeah, 115 people to figure out dinner.
And there's always, if not, maybe there's like a couple hours a day where there's someone not there. But when you talk about that 115 people, it's like 2 a.m. to bake bread or something all the way through.
4 hours a day we don't use our kitchen. So it's 20, it takes us 20 hours to open for what is essentially 5 hours of dinner time service. So a lot of prep obviously goes into that. And yeah, sure, you're baking bread and setting things up. Sometimes it takes a couple of days to make. But today we served, you know, about 1,200 people through the drive-through. We served about, I don't know, somewhere in the range of 300 people for breakfast. Tonight we'll send a couple hundred dinners out for delivery. So it's a much different impact for us, and we're not exactly set up for it. So we're trying to figure that out as we go. But today was a day of rest for us. It felt so. Every day this week we've opened a new restaurant concept. We started on Monday with a drive-through. Tuesday we added bagels, and yesterday we added home delivery. So today we were just sort of refining some of those systems again, and it was kind of nice just to run them and see how we could tweak it.
So let's get right into, you know, this show is adapting. It's now 70 years that your family has run Canless Fine Dining, and in 2 weeks really since you started planning, you've thrown that out the window, and now you're doing these three different things. Like, can you walk us through, when was the moment you realized that this was going to happen and you needed to change?
A couple weeks ago now, my wife and I were in New York City doing something for the James Beard Awards, and we got the news that Seattle had its first case. And we went back to the hotel and just sort of talking through, like, you know, this thing's coming. It's here. It's here in Seattle. And what does that mean? What does it mean for our family? What does it mean for not just our marriage and our own children, but our extended family? I have parents who are in their 70s. What does it mean for the restaurant family, for the staff? And a couple of days later, back at home, we had a meeting as a team, and we just said, you guys, let's really think through this a little bit. While we were having that meeting, King County or governor, I can't even remember who it was, but someone official announced, had this live stream and kind of came on and said, hey, this is a much bigger deal than we thought. And, you know, it's like at first you just kind of have, it's like the sucker punch to the system. You know, you've got the wind taken out of you a little bit. And then pretty quickly we realized that it would be just as risky to do nothing as it would to do something really radical. And if we were going to live into our values, then, you know, every once in a while that really is probably going to cost you something. And in this way, it was going to cost shutting down what was still a profitable business for the unknown of opening up three new ones. And the reason we're doing three is because, again, it just took that many ideas to get all of my staff up to having all the hours they would have normally had. And that was the goal here. So we started with the drive-through. For those that don't know, we're a fine dining restaurant looking this direction. But if you turn around, we're on a really busy road, you know, and that's not ideal. No one would plan that out these days. But we just said, okay, what do we have? Like starting with what do we have to be thankful for? And then what assets are at our disposal here? If we started from scratch, how would we play this? And I remember watching the live stream. We were all sort of huddled on the couch there, the team. There's seven of us on.
This is all in this meeting.
This is like in the meeting. And we do these like 3-hour offsites, and we go to one of somebody's home so we can like kind of feel what it's like to be welcomed into their home personally. So we're sitting on Marin's sofa, and which is not a 7-person sofa. It's like a 3 or 4 person sofa. And we're all kind of like huddled and watching this thing. And yeah, I think it just hit us that like the game isn't up. Like, wait a second, this isn't over. This is just beginning. And I think we'd all gone in with this sentiment of helplessness, if we're honest, maybe hopelessness. I think there was a feeling of, okay, I gotta batten the hatches. I gotta hunker down. I gotta, you know, and
protect. Yeah.
Protect. And that's a lousy strategy in a lot of things. Soccer being one of them. It's like you see it in sports all the time when an entire team sort of switches to defense and loses their offense, like suddenly you're like, ah, don't do that. Wait a minute. Like, keep playing your game. And for us, we're like, if we're going to keep playing our game, we just need to admit that the game changed. And the game now, currently today, and this is 2 weeks ago, was no one understands the 6-foot rule, and no one understands what is socially acceptable. We don't understand if we should be shutting down schools and public places, or if that is, you know, building a fear that, right? So this is happening so quickly, but so we just said, well, today,
was it
what
clear
we
know,
right now,
at that moment that like the game had changed?
We just got the sense that it was going to. Yeah, it hadn't yet, but it was like the writing is on the wall. And I think nobody wanted to actually say that out loud, but it felt that way a couple of weeks ago. And so,
well, I can tell you from the outside, the way it sort of felt is you made a more drastic move earlier than most places. Like, I think in the next week, a lot of places started trying to figure out what does it mean for us to do delivery. But I will say from the outside, the way it looked was, and frankly, part of what inspired David and I for this was, oh my God, that was decisive. And that was severe and extreme.
And risky. Like you guys.
I wish I could take credit for that. Let me tell you where a lot of that credit belongs. First off, we have an incredible board of directors and some advisors who are just remarkable sounding boards for us. Both of our wives were really key into sort of speaking into how we were perceiving the world. And I think in this time, it was a time of just great perception, trying to understand and make sense of what we were hearing, how it pertained to us and our team. But really, when we launched this with the executive team, we said, you know, this thing could work. That's to say, there's a chance the boat is taking on water, and there's a chance it might sink. And also, there's a chance there's a lifeboat on the end. Will someone just go to the end of the ship and see if there's a lifeboat? That's kind of what that meeting felt like. And somebody came back and said, you know, as it turns out, there is a lifeboat on the back of the ship. Like, we could all get in it, right? And so I was like, huh. So we sat on that as a team for about 24 hours. Two days later, I was having dinner with our staff, and we're all sitting around having family meal, talking this through. And I just said, you guys, let me just tell you where my head's at. And I'm scared to tell you because I don't know what it means. But this is what we're thinking about as a team. And it would mean all of you need to re-volunteer to work here. They would mean all of you choosing to be in a position, choosing not to be laid off or temporarily furloughed, choosing to actually continue to do this thing. And would any of you be interested? And not only that group of sort of five or six of us sitting around the table, but the next night in a staff meeting, announcing it to the entire team, this is up to you. You don't have to do this. And every one of them saying, we're in, you know, put me in, coach. And I think that was just such a boost of encouragement to us. It's like, if you guys are in, we're in, and let's do this, right? It had like that sort of sentiment to it. It was like, okay, why not? And I think at some point you say to yourself in any time of crisis, if I have the ability to help, why am I not doing it? And that is what it felt like to us. It felt like this could be an encouragement to the city. It was clearly an encouragement to the staff. And it was for us just a way through, a way that, and an untested, untried way. But I don't know, we thought we'd give it a whirl.
That's awesome. We want to thank our longtime friend of the show, Vanta, the leading trust management platform. Vanta, of course, automates your security reviews and compliance efforts. So frameworks like SOC 2, ISO 27001, GDPR, and HIPAA compliance and monitoring, Vanta takes care of these otherwise incredibly time and resource draining efforts for your organization and makes them fast and simple.
Yep. Vanta is the perfect example of the quote that we talk about all the time here on Acquired. Jeff Bezos, his idea that a company should only focus on what actually makes your beer taste better, i.e. spend your time and resources only on what's actually going to move the needle for your product and your customers and outsource everything else that doesn't. Every company needs compliance and trust with their vendors and customers. It plays a major role in enabling revenue because customers and partners demand it, but yet it adds zero flavor to your actual product.
Vanta takes care of all of it for you. No more spreadsheets, no fragmented tools, no manual reviews to cobble together your security and compliance requirements. It is one single software pane of glass that connects to all of your services via APIs and eliminates countless hours of work for your organization. There are now AI capabilities to make this even more powerful, and they even integrate with over 300 external tools. Plus, they let customers build private integrations with their internal systems.
And perhaps most importantly, your security reviews are now real-time instead of static, so you can monitor and share with your customers and partners to give them added confidence.
So whether you're a startup or a large enterprise and your company is ready to automate compliance and streamline security reviews like Vanta's 7,000 customers around the globe, and go back to making your beer taste better, head on over to vanta.com/acquired and just tell them that Ben and David sent you. And thanks to friend of the show, Christina, Vanta's CEO, all acquired listeners get $1,000 of free credit. Vanta.com/acquired.
I want to talk about communication and language. And the language you guys use and have always used, but particularly now, is really inspiring. But before we get to that, can we go back to the three concepts you guys are doing? Breakfast, the bagel shed, drive-through lunch, and then delivery for dinner. Where did they come from?
There's also a fourth concept coming, which I'm super stoked about. But I can kind of walk you through all three of those. The first one was the drive-through. We saw that as being the biggest revenue generator. We have a ridiculous amount of labor here. It's the most expensive thing. And we knew that one of these concepts had to actually work. And so geographically, if you understand the way this restaurant works, you can pull right off of the street, right under our porte-cochere. You can stay in your car and you can roll right on down the driveway. And it was like, that's what we knew we needed, that the cleanliness there, the ability to not have any contact with the guest, but still sort of be facing them. And so, yeah, we were embracing our inner drive-through as a fine dining restaurant. It was just like, yes, this is us. Come on, let's just let it out of the bag. And chef can cook a remarkable burger. And we've always joked about doing this sort of traditional salad of ours, the canola salad, as a to-go item. And like, yeah, why not? Like, let's just do burgers and ice cream sandwiches and salad to go. It's like, I don't know. Sometimes that's all you need.
Can you talk about average ticket price for each of these three concepts?
Yeah, and burger sort of price how that would compare $14. So, you know what? We have designed this thing not to make money. I think it's a little bit weird to be... This is a tricky thing. I don't think there's anything unethical about making money in this time. In a certain sense, we have a duty to do so, but mostly as a means of protecting the staff. And to be clear, we're only 4 days in. I don't know if we are. That's to say, the bagel concepts clearly does not make money. It's labor intensive. We don't have the equipment to scale that in any way such that we could move that to be a profitable business. We could raise the prices, but that just feels dirty. So the point, again, is to keep people employed. So with burgers, we probably make a little extra. With bagels, we're definitely losing. With dinner, as we scale that up, that'll be profitable. And somehow, if we can get to break even. Even from the onset, that's what the goal was like, it'd be amazing if for the next 3 months, Canlis could not lose money. I think that'll posture us really well coming out of this thing on the other side. And I do think of it as a few months, not just a few weeks. So, bagels came out of the idea of, well, we're going to be really busy for lunch. Our expediter happens to be this incredible woman from the Lower East Side of Manhattan. She's a baker and she makes a ridiculous bagel. And Chef is from Brooklyn and he vouched. He was like, that's the best bagel I've had in New York City or in Seattle. We happen to have a bread oven and a shipping container, and it was like a no-brainer. So we just opened the bagel shed and we're doing, you know, everything bagels with fried eggs and homemade sausage and cheese. And
can you sell the bagels as an add-on to dinner for like breakfast at home the next morning?
Well, that'd be a good idea. We sell out of bagels in under an hour. So it's a full-time crew of eight making these things, and that whole idea lasts an hour. So we actually thought about intentionally slowing the line so that, because again, the idea is to keep everyone employed here, but no, we've been blowing through them too quickly. So we're looking at taking over another bakery that is closed, and maybe we can use their space and kind of scale it up a little bit higher somewhere.
Yeah, I did see something. It was like you had some message on your website this morning. Like, unfortunately, bagels are sold out as of 8:37 a.m.
Yeah, they've been going nuts. So the last concept of just doing family meal at home. You know, we cook an amazing family meal for the staff. That's the meal that twice a day chef prepares for our team. And we always joke about like one of the best restaurants in the city actually being Canlis's family meal. Like, it's so good. The pastry chef is making cobblers and the bartenders are like making homemade sodas and chef is like, hey, this is my mama's meatloaf. And this is like enchilada from Nico, who's been prepping all day. And it's so good. And it kind of kills us that the rest of the city doesn't get to see what these guys are capable of outside of fine dining. And so we just thought, okay, well, that's a no-brainer. Like, why don't we just keep making family meal? We don't need a big menu. Delivery is tough to figure out. And making a transition like this, I think if you can keep it simple, you should. And so we offer one thing a night. The very first night, it was cassoulet because we had all these dry aged ducks. We're like, what are we going to do with ducks? And moreover, I have a farm saying, are you going to take delivery of ducks going forward? And we need a way to say yes. So tonight it is a rabbit pot pie and glazed carrots. And it's I had it for lunch. It's insane. It's so, so good. So we just thought, shoot, we can bake all that stuff here, pack it up, throw a bottle of wine in it. And my servers, who used to take food from the kitchen to the table, are now just taking it to the parking lot and right on down the street a little way. So it keeps them employed and it keeps my kitchen cooking all night long. And it's kind of been fun.
That's so cool. How, technically, how did you make that happen? You guys adapted. You've been on TOC, the reservation and ticketing system, for a while. How did you work with TOC to make this happen?
The guys at TOC were awesome. We called them early on and we're like, we have this crazy idea and we're actually trying to like hack the system. It's so TOC is a reservation system for those that don't know. And those guys are awesome. And we were trying to see if we could morph the reservation system into a delivery system. And we just about figured out, and they called like, you guys, stop it. Hold on a second. We can do this. Give us 5 minutes. 5 minutes later, they call back and they said, we stood our company down. We're turning it back on. We just called everybody in. They're in Chicago. And we're just going to work on this so you have the platform. And they cranked it out, working around the clock for a couple of days. And we were able to launch. And so that is a mechanism that any restaurant in the country, look, not everybody can do drive-through. I mean, it's just the physicality of it. So the location is going to work for them. But any restaurant or company could do delivery. And now that we've got the software for it, it's just, it's not, you know, overtly tricky.
Can you talk through any restaurant in the country can do delivery? I'm sure there's a lot of folks that own restaurants that are listening to this. What does that take?
It takes a little guts and it takes just that kind of good old fashioned restaurant scrappiness that every restaurateur already has. If you're in this business, I guarantee you have what it takes, because it's just the same thing it takes to run a restaurant. It's a little bit of, the willpower just to make it happen. That's, I think, what all of us are going through. So all we did was figure out a menu and we launched a website. So someone that knows what to do on the internet, that's not me, but our design team drew up a little logo, which is not necessary. We threw a little splash page on top of canlis.com, which is also not necessary. You could just post on Instagram. Having to switch to delivery, so appreciate you supporting us doing this. You can do various versions of it. It's pretty fancy. Our servers have it all on their phones. They get the maps. They get the texts. We can do drop-offs, no contact drop-offs. We can do alcohol. Again, TOC made all that possible. But you can keep it really simple. It takes ordering some boxes and some to-go containers, coming up with one thing that holds hot really well, and letting your constituency know that tonight's a great night for takeout. So yeah, we sold out 3 nights worth of takeout in about 90 minutes.
Wow. One question that I have that I'd be remiss if I didn't ask, and I'll give a little context for listeners. So Canlis is innovative, not just in the way that over the last 60, 70 years, you guys have changed fine dining, which we haven't talked about on this episode, but Mark's given some great talks that you can sort of read about and the evolution of fine dining and Canlis's role in it, but also in doing these wild experiments that you would not expect the finest dining in the city to also have a Shake Shack pop up in the parking lot before there was a Shake Shack, or you would not have expected.
But why wouldn't you? Can we uncover that a little bit? Do you mind if we dig into why you wouldn't expect a fine dining restaurant to do that? Yeah, definitely one of the reasons I think this transition has been possible for us is that we practice this kind of thing. And by that, I don't just mean events in our parking lot. I mean, if you want to be a restaurant that is around, let alone relevant or germane to the conversation, you're doing a fair amount of this every year anyway. People always ask Brian and I, how come you guys haven't opened a second restaurant? I'm like, you just don't know it. But we open a second restaurant about every 18 months. I would say that's how often the systems inside of Canlis are changing. And those are being rewritten by new employees and employees that have been here 20 years. The idea is that there's probably a better way to do it than the way that we're doing it. We just kind of believe that. And so I think if you want to matter, you need to earn that right. And to earn it, you got to be working all the time at opening a restaurant that's really good. And tonight we're good. Tomorrow will be better. And that's not news to anyone. I think what happens, that's to say, that's not a strategy that no one's heard before. If you're in business, you get it, right? And maybe thank you to the Japanese who made that a very popular concept, you know, in the late 80s and 90s. But like, we're all sort of thinking that way. What happens is it's really easy to get lazy. It's really easy to start to devalue that as the thing is working. And of course, if you go too far with that, maybe you're undoing things that still had a usable lifespan inside of them, right? So you hate to take a system down that would have been amazing for the next, you know, foreseeable future. So that takes a little, I don't know, sorting through. You got to be careful there, but welcome to business. It's a delicate balance, right? So,
and less listeners think that, we're just talking about a one-time thing, opening up a Shake Shack. I went to your restaurant last summer. And when I say restaurant, I mean parking lot for the Hawaiian Nights Luau, where, listeners, it's the largest hot tub you've ever seen.
It's 24 feet long.
It's up on like a second story deck overlooking you guys opened a little pizza shop and like a multi-story hangout.
We wanted a swim up bar, which we created. And then we also had, so we built a couple of tiki huts and
am I right? You bought the swimming pool on Amazon?
Well, no. So we like to test things out on staff parties. And the goal of a staff party is to throw one that the staff would willingly come to if they had no association with the restaurant, right? So if you just said, look, you guys, it's a true day off or it's a true night off. Like, do whatever you want. And also, we're going to be throwing this party over here. And it's like totally like no expectation come. Only let me just talk about it. And so... anyway, yeah, at some point we were throwing a luau. Oh, yeah, we had covered the parking lot in sod because we were like, it's not cool to throw a party in a parking lot in cement, and wouldn't it be cool if it was grass? So we sodded the thing over and we threw a volleyball party and we had a pig roasting. And somebody said at some point, well, every luau needs a beach. So we like brought in sand, and then I went on Amazon. I'm like, no way, you can buy a pool for like $2,000. Well, that's cheaper than... You know, in the world of staff parties, the stuff adds up quickly. So anyway, we bought a pool and we filled it up. And then it just kind of like went from there. So then that was a really successful party. And we were thinking about fun things we could do over the summer. And we thought, well, why don't we just throw the staff party for the city? And honestly, you guys, I thought like a few hundred people would come. Like, who goes to a parking lot at a fine dining restaurant to hang out in an above ground pool, right? Like, it's... Yeah, like 1,200 people came a night. Like, it was nuts. And all of them waited an hour or two to get in. So that caught us by surprise a little bit. But it was also a ton of fun. I mean, a DJ on top of a shipping container and underneath you're baking the best pizzas and roasting pigs. And I don't know what happened out there, but it was tons of fun. So we do like to just sort of think through these things. And I think it's a little bit of a good exercise. Look, just because we're fine dining doesn't mean we're not thinking of 99 other ideas to do. And to us, it's kind of like the Formula One version of putting out a sedan. It's like, why don't we go push this as far as we can? Let's see what happens. And every one of these projects finds its way back onto our menu. Every one of these projects influences what we believe about hospitality. And you need that stuff. You need to be inspired by it. Your people, you need to be inspired by it. And
yeah,
it's fun.
This is a great time to tell you about one of our very favorite companies, Crusoe.
So Crusoe, as listeners know by now, is a clean compute cloud provider specifically built for AI workloads. NVIDIA is one of their major partners, and literally Crusoe's data centers are nothing but racks and racks of A100s and H100s. And because Crusoe's cloud is purpose-built for AI and run on wasted, stranded, or clean energy, they can provide significantly better performance per dollar than traditional cloud providers.
Yes, we talked about that on our ACQ2 episode with Crusoe CEO Chase Lockmiller.
The other element that makes Crusoe special is the environmental angle. Crusoe, of course, locates their data centers at stranded energy sites. So think oil flares, wind farms that can't use all the energy they generate, etc., and uses that power that would otherwise be wasted to run your AI workloads instead.
Yep. Obviously, it's a huge benefit for the environment and for customers on costs, since Crusoe doesn't rely on the energy grid. Energy is the second largest cost of running AI after, of course, the price you pay NVIDIA for the chips. And these lower energy costs get passed on to customers.
It's super cool that they can put their data centers out there in these remote locations where, quote unquote, energy happens, as opposed to the other hyperscalers such as AWS and Google and Azure, who need to build their data centers close to major traffic hubs where the internet happens because they are doing everything in their clouds.
Yep. If you, your company, or your portfolio companies would like to use the lower cost and more performant infrastructure for your AI workloads, go to crusoecloud.com/acquired. That's crusoecloud.com/acquired, or click the link in the show notes. So as we start to wind down here, that's the question on my mind is, I know it's only been 4 days, but of the three restaurants you talked about and fourth that we'll keep under wraps for now, what do you think might make its way into Canlis when we live in a normal world again?
Here's what I hope makes its way into Canlis. I hope that what comes out of this is a visceral reminder of how alike we all are. And if there's anything that I think we've learned so far, it's that our understanding of the human spirit is limited at best. And it's only when you come to me and say, Mark, I think you got this, man. And when I reflect that back to you and say, look, Ben, you got this, right? Like that's what happens. Something really powerful happens there. And the whole mission of this company, which is, I know, a really weird mission, but it's to inspire people to turn toward one another. And when we saw the disease spreading, and I am not talking about COVID-19, I am talking about the amount of fear, the amount of discouragement, when we saw that spreading, and often for really good reason, these are not insignificant days. This is a good, overused, but good word. This is unprecedented for the entire world to go through something together where no one gets to say, yeah, it doesn't apply to me, right? When something like that happens, I think we have a responsibility to remind ourselves of the truth. And the truth is we don't know what we're capable of. We, the Canlis team, we, the city of Seattle, we, the United States of America, we, the citizens of this rock that we're floating around on. And I hope that we understand that better on the other side of this thing. And that's what we're learning. That's what we're learning inside this building. I don't know if we might not be able to do this tomorrow. Or maybe this will go for months. I don't know. But every day I tell the team, I was like, hey, look, you're going to want to go home and crawl under your covers and read your phone. And it is important to do so. But when you wake up the next morning, you go outside, you physically go outside of your house, your apartment, you look up at the sky and ask yourself the question, is it still up there or did it fall? And if it's still up there, you can be thankful for that. And you start with what you're thankful with. You say, all right, the sky did not fall, contrary to the way I feel, having read all the headlines. It's still up there. I hear a bird tweeting. I see a neighbor walking down the street. You know what? Let's start with what we have. Let's go from there. And let's ask ourselves the question, if this is what I have, what can I do with it? And I don't know. Maybe what we get out of this whole thing is that as a discipline, as a practice, as a reminder that, I don't know, maybe that's a reminder that we need right now. I think it's a reminder that I needed. And I think it's a reminder that my team needed. And I wish you could feel the difference inside this place before and after we made this decision. Before, it was a feeling of helplessness, and after, it was a feeling of hope. Before, it was a feeling that the overwhelming weight of this thing was too much. And after, it was the understanding that I had a role to play. And that even just enduring a little bit might be my role. And I think when we tell those stories, then we start to remind ourselves the truth of who we are as people. And that's pretty cool. That's why we wrote on that website, "We Got This, Seattle." It was the most poignant way I could say to a city that needed to hear it, we are capable of making it through.
So. Well, I cannot think of a single better way to leave this episode and leave our very first episode of Adapted than with that line. So, Mark, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Anything else you want to tell listeners or tell them, you know, where they should go get some great food?
I do want to tell listeners something. Yeah. I think they have the ability, even though it doesn't feel this way, to make a difference. What we've been talking about here is my restaurant. And you know what you don't have? You don't have my restaurant, and you probably don't have a restaurant. To dismiss this as someone else's story in a city that you don't live in, I think would be a great, what would make me sad. I think to hear this and to know that if we're crazy enough to give this a whirl, maybe some of your crazy is okay too. And I hope it gives them permission to think optimistically. I hope it gives them permission to smile at a neighbor. Keep it 6 feet away. I don't care. You can still smile at them. And so that's not insignificant. It's important. And it's going to take all of us remembering that about ourselves, remembering that that is who we are as people. So this is a story about our country. And largely, this is a story about well beyond our borders and how alike we all really are. So that's all I got, guys.
Amen. Let's all go do not exactly what you're doing, but do what we all can to.
You're all welcome to open a drive through. I'm not against it. I think competition only makes us better, but but you're gonna have some steep competition. The burgers are pretty good.
Well, it is on my calendar to come tomorrow morning. I think hopefully around 7:30 to the bagel shed and pick one up. So
do it. Swing on through. Awesome. I'd love to see you here.
Thanks so much, Mark. Listeners, we will catch you for the next one.
Thanks, guys.
See you next time.